Good morning. This is Pat, and I'm reading from the Clinton Journal for September the 5th. Event marks Constellation Meta Agreement. Clinton. Hundreds of community members and labor leaders joined employees from Constellation last week at the Clinton Clean Energy Center to mark an agreement between Constellation and Meta. The agreement secures the long-term future of the plant and its ability to produce power for the Midwest energy grid. The celebration follows the announcement of a 20-year agreement that supports the continued operation, expansion, and relicensing of the Clinton facility following the expiration of the state's Zero Emission Credit Program in May 2027. With the future of the plant secure, Constellation officials said the company could evaluate opportunities for additional nuclear capacity at the site. Now more than ever, it's critical that we maintain and expand all sources of clean, reliable energy, and thanks to Meta's investment, the future of Clinton Clean Energy Center and its contributions to this community are secure, said Kathleen Barone, Constellation Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy and Growth Officer. With Meta's support and backing of state and local leaders, hundreds of jobs, millions of dollars in state and local taxes, and all the economic benefits of Clinton are here to stay. Delivering power to the grid for the next two decades at zero cost to utility customers. Nuclear energy is a vital component of our energy to support Meta's A1 ambitions. By partnering with Constellation at the Clinton Clean Energy Center, we are ensuring a stable and reliable power source that bolsters grid resilience and supports thousands of local jobs, said Kevin Janda, Director, Global Data Center Strategy of Meta. This collaboration not only strengthens the grid's infrastructure, but also contributes to the economic vitality of the region and helps bolster Americans' leadership in AI. The Clinton Clean Energy Center's economic and environmental impacts are significant, according to Constellation. The facility directly employs more than 530 people, contributes approximately $13.5 million in annual taxes, and generates enough emissions-free electricity to power over 800,000 homes. An analysis by the Brattle Group found that if the plant were to close, emissions would rise by more than 34 metric tons over 20 years, the equivalent of putting approximately 7.4 million gasoline-powered cars on the road for 1 year. The same study found that Illinois' GDP would fall by $765 million annually, with impacts rippling across multiple industries. The agreement with Meta prevents these consequences and secures the plant's continued contributions to the region, Constellation officials said. This agreement is a victory for union workers, for Clinton, and for the future of clean energy in Illinois, said Bobby Waddell, business manager of IBEW Local 51. Our members have proudly powered this facility for decades, and thanks to the partnership between Constellation and Meta, we can look ahead with confidence. This deal secures hundreds of good-paying, highly skilled jobs right here in central Illinois and reinforces what we have always known. Nuclear energy and union labor are essential to building a strong, sustainable economy. Constellation also reaffirmed its pledge to invest $1 million over 5 years, beginning in 2026, to support workforce development, social services, education, and local nonprofits in Clinton and surrounding areas. So far in 2025, Constellation has donated $150,000 to local charitable initiatives, including $45,000 to the Neighborhood Care Center for critical facility updates, to the DeWitt County 4-H Fairgrounds for infrastructure improvements, and more than $20,000 in scholarships for students at area schools such as Clinton High School, Hayforth Junior Senior High School, and Heartland Community College. The Clinton Clean Energy Center has long been an excellent partner for our community, and today's celebration marks the end of a new era, said Clinton Mayor Helen Michalassi. We're grateful to Constellation and Meta for investing not in just in clean energy, but in our community agencies and the people of Clinton. This agreement protects jobs, strengthens our local tax base, and paves the way for even greater opportunity in the years ahead. It's a big win for our residents, our schools, and our future. Constellation's investment in the Neighborhood Care Center is transformational, said Cody Monkman, Network Director at NCC. Their support doesn't just help improve our facilities, it strengthens our ability to serve Clinton and McLean County for years to come. This partnership marks the beginning of an exciting new chapter for our organization and the communities we support. With confidence in the plant's continued operation, Constellation is also evaluating opportunities to extend the site's early site permit or pursue a new construction permit from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to enable the potential development of an advanced reactor or a small modular reactor at the Clinton site. The agreement also enables Constellation to add new clean energy to the grid at the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators Zone 4 territory, which spans central and southern Illinois. As part of the deal, the Clinton facility will add 30 megawatts of increased output through nuclear updates. The Clinton Clean Energy Center was originally licensed in 1987 and supplies enough electricity to power more than 800,000 homes. And now from the op-ed page, from the Mac Desk by Billy McMacken. After Labor Day, a thank you to the people who keep us moving. From shop floors to classrooms, fields to freeways, your work matters. The calendar has already flipped past Labor Day, but the gratitude shouldn't. If anything, the day after is a perfect time to look around our towns and notice all the people whose everyday effort keeps DeWitt County running. The folks who don't get a parade, who rarely ask for attention, and who go to work anyway. I think of teachers greeting a new class and the bus drivers who get kids there on time. I think of nurses, CNAs, and techs, of linemen and utility crews who lace up when most of us are still asleep. I think of factory teams, farmers, first responders, city workers, custodians, clerks, mechanics, caregivers, and the small business owners who unlock the door before dawn so the coffee is hot when we walk in. There's pride in a good day's work, and our communities are built on it. That lesson started early for me. I grew up in Brookings, South Dakota, watching my mom, Lily, put in a 40-year career at 3M. She showed me that showing up every day is a decision and a discipline. My dad, William, drove a truck and logged a lot of long miles and longer hours. From both of them, I learned that work isn't about titles. It's about responsibility, craft, and doing the job right, even when no one is watching. Maybe that sounds old-fashioned. I don't think it is. The future still belongs to people who care about the quality of their work. It belongs to young people learning a trade, mid-career folks reinventing themselves, and retirees who still volunteer because service never really retires. It belongs to the crews who plow our roads, the teams who fix a water main in the rain, the postal workers and delivery drivers who make sure medicine and groceries arrive on time. Here in the Clinton area, we see this every day. It's a neighbor stopping to jump a battery. It's a waitress remembering your order. It's a coach rolling out balls after practice so a couple of kids can shoot a little longer. It's an editor, yes, you, Gordon, who chases school board agendas and a press crew that runs late so the paper lands on your porch. It's work, honest, necessary, often unseen, and it deserves a thank you. If you're clocking in today, this is for you. If you're between shifts or between jobs, keep going. Your skills and your grit matter. If you're mentoring a younger coworker, thank you. If you're training for a certification at night, keep studying. And if you're leading a team, remember the people do their best work when they know they're valued. So a belated Happy Labor Day and a sincere salute to the people who keep our towns moving. Let's keep noticing the helpers, tipping a little better when we can, and telling the stories that remind us we're all connected by the work we do for one another. Thanks, Mama and Pops, for teaching me what work really means, and thanks to all of you who live it out one shift at a time. Bill McMacken is the owner of the Clinton Journal. When it comes to work these days, Toby Keith summed it best by saying that Billy's not as good as he once was, but he's as good once as he ever was. And now from Senior Newsline by Matilda Charles. Retirement regrets? I was eavesdropping on two senior ladies in a big box store, specifically in the furniture aisle. Being discussed was a very large TV cabinet with doors and shelving. While it was on sale, the price was apparently not enticing. I regret not buying a big television back when I had the money for one, before I went on Social Security, said one. I hear that, replied the other one, but my regret is moving into a place that's too small for me to even have a big TV cabinet like this. And there I was, enticed. What is it we all most regret now that we are seniors? I posed the question to AI. Our most common regret, says the artificial intelligence, is that we didn't save enough for retirement, or that we didn't start saving early enough in our lives. Money was a major theme, according to AI, especially when it came to underestimating health care and expenses. For a different take on things, I turned to my local informal poll group. The replies ranged from, I regret moving into a community with no sidewalks, to I regret to not getting a cat because now I've reached the cutoff age and the animal shelter won't let me adopt a very young cat because I might die before the cat does. The third one chuckled, well, I regret encouraging my son to take that job across the country because now he's not around to do the heavy lifting. Another was serious when he replied, I wish I'd bought a boat. It would be paid for by now. I'd head for the Bahamas. If you're curious about what kinds of regrets seniors have about retirement, especially if you haven't yet retired and have time to make a course correction in your retirement plans, do online search for the biggest regrets for retirees or something similar. And now for some sports. Clinton hosts annual Light Up the Night event by Mark Rogers, The Clinton Journal. Clinton. The Clinton Maroons cross-country team hosted its annual Light Up the Night Invitational on Saturday, August the 30th at Clinton High School. What began several years ago as a dream competition has grown significantly in size. The first run of the invite had 8 teams signed up. 6 showed up to the starting line. This year there were 42 teams with 735 runners in the competition. The large number of buses transporting teams this year forced spectator parking to wherever there was an open space. This reporter arrived early and parked about a quarter to a third of a mile away. The meeting was set up in 3 races, each 3 miles long, approximately a 5K run. First was the open class with junior varsity and any varsity runners not qualified for the varsity races. The second race included the top 5 runners of the team. Others ran as well, but only the 5 top runners of the team receive a score. The course began on the west practice field of the high school and circled once. Then the runners passed in front of the school and around the Clinton West Side Water Tower. From there, the teams proceed around the baseball and softball diamonds for two loops, ending on the track around the football field. All field and facility lights were on to illuminate the course, and Clinton Fire Department helped out, too, with some of their lighting equipment. The open race began at 7 p.m. and was run in 16.2 minutes. The winner was Keegan DeWall of Gibson City, Melvin Sibley, with Clinton's Braxton Dalton taking third place. Clinton took second place in the team standings. The second race was the boys' varsity race with state champion Chaz Obergfell of Gillespie. However, there was no contention. Obergfell took a fairly large lead away from the hometown Maroons and won the race in 14.41 minutes. Clinton's Caden Bostic hung in a secure fourth place and assists the team to a second place finish. The final run of the evening was the varsity girls race. This run probably was the most exciting of the evening, even with some of the close finishes in other races. Claire Eichner of Maroa Forsyth took an early lead and just kept increasing her lead through the entire, finishing at 17.7 minutes, well ahead of her closest opponent by about 40 yards. The team standings, Shelbyville was the first in Muhammad Seymour in second. The Clinton ladies fell back and finished 12th out of 17 teams. The finale was a fireworks demonstration in the darkened football stadium. And now, Maroons rated in start to season by Mark Rogers, the Clinton Journal. The Clinton Maroons started the official football season by hosting the Central A&M Ocaw Valley Raiders, and quite a start it was. After missing the playoff by one game last season, the Maroon starter this year hurt a little. The Maroons are with a young team, approximately half freshmen, so there are some rebuilding to do. The Raiders came in after going 8-1 in the conference last year and appear to be on track for that or better this year. The Raiders won the coin toss and elected to receive the ball. On their second play from scrimmage, the Raiders scored a long touchdown pass run with an extra point for a quick 7-0 lead. From there, the game went into a midfield tussle of turnovers on downs and punts. The Raiders took over on the Clinton 40-yard line and made a first down, and on the next two pass plays made a second touchdown with extra point for the 14-0 lead. The Marines took over and quickly lost the ball on downs. The Raiders proceeded to capitalize on this turnover with another passing touchdown with the extra point for a 21-0 lead. On the ensuing kickoff, the Maroons fumbled and the Raiders were right there to recover the ball. It took the Raiders three plays to score their fourth touchdown and an extra point for a commanding 28-0 lead at halftime. The second play of the second half, the home team fumbled and lost the ball. The next play resulted in another Raider score and extra point for a 35-0 lead. The Maroons then turned the ball over again on downs, at which point the visitors again score in three plays for an overwhelming 42-0 lead. As the fourth quarter began, Clinton received the ball and managed to score a touchdown in five plays. The two-point extra point failed, leaving the score at 42-6 in favor of the opposition. The Marines held for the last series of downs, stopping the bleeding at a 42-6 loss. Next week, the Maroons face the Warrensburg Latham Cardinals in an away game, followed by a home game against the Seneca Fighting Irish. Eastern Illinois Food Bank gathers resources for Hunger Action Month. Urbana. September marks the 18th year Feeding America, the nation's largest domestic hunger relief organization, has organized a national call to action through Hunger Action Month. This Hunger Action Month Eastern Illinois Food Bank is calling on East Central Illinois to come together once again to end hunger in America. People across the country have demonstrated immense care for their neighbors in crisis time after time, helping to build stronger, more resilient communities, said Claire Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America. Ending the hunger crisis in America is no different. When we all work together alongside our neighbors facing hunger, we can find solutions to ensure that everyone has the food they need to thrive. This Hunger Action Month, our hope for the nation is to start building this new reality together through unified action toward the shared vision of a hunger-free America. Food insecurity in America has reached its highest rate in over a decade, reaching over 47 million people facing hunger, including 14 million children. Of the communities Eastern Illinois Food Bank serves, we see food insecurity ranging from a low of 9.9% in Piatt County to a high of 16.5% in Coles County. Eastern Illinois Food Bank is not immune to the rising costs and limited resources impacting the neighbors we serve, said Food Bank President and CEO Kelly Daly. This Hunger Action Month, we want everyone to know that no action is too small to make a difference as we work to meet a historic need. Through our generous community coming together, our mission of alleviating hunger for local families is possible. With the largest cuts to SNAP and Medicaid in history now signed into law, food and health care will soon be further out of the reach for millions of people, including children. Hunger in America is a crisis, and together we can meet this moment. People can get involved locally through the actions below. Donate. Visit eifoodbank.org/action/donate to make a gift to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Every $1 donated provides 3 meals to a neighbor experiencing hunger. Volunteer. Sign up to repack food for local families on Thursday, September 8th at the annual Operation Orange volunteer event at mobilize.us/eifoodbank/event/823909 or bring the family to volunteer at the Kids Zone repack on Saturday, September the 20th. Sign up at mobilize.us/eifoodbank/event/824726. Raise awareness. Wear orange on Tuesday, September 9 for Hunger Action Day to raise awareness of hunger. Post photos on social media and tag at EI Food Bank. And now a column by King Features Syndicate. Rich Lowry is the columnist. The National Guard isn't the Gestapo. Donald Trump's alleged fascist crackdown is finally here. Federal troops are on the streets of major U.S. cities with almost certainly more on the way. First they came for Los Angeles, then for Washington, D.C., and next, if reports are to be believed, Chicago. There's no doubt that Trump loves the optics and sense of strength that comes with deploying the National Guard to U.S. cities, while many of his political enemies love the thrill of decrying the arrival of dystopia they've always warned about. The Guard's troops obviously aren't Trump's equivalent of Mussolini's squadristi or Hitler's brown shirts, brawlers and enforcers operating outside the law to crush a political party's opponents. They are well-trained, entirely lawful military force that isn't engaging in street fights or arresting dissidents. The Guard's role has mostly been to stand in front of federal buildings and other public landmarks. In Washington, D.C., they walk along metro platforms and generally make themselves visible, They are often seen drinking coffee and taking photos with tourists. In short, they've been a benign presence, although still a political flashpoint. For Trump, the Guard deployments are an emblem of the restoration of public order. Nothing says the lawman is back in town quite like Humvees parked in front of Union Station and camouflaged federal troops walking the streets. That the troops are overkill makes them even more potent as a symbol. Trump really means it. Then they generate a reaction from his opponents is even better, since it prompts them into attacking a token of lawfulness in places that suffer from endemic disorder. So Trump feels an urge to take the show on a national tour, with the Windy City or perhaps Baltimore as the next stop. This is a bad idea. D.C. and L.A. present unique circumstances not replicated in other cities. Legally, D.C. is an easy question. Although Congress has granted D.C. home rule, the federal government has plenary power over the district. The President of the United States has direct authority over the D.C. National Guard and can also take control of the city's police department. Constitutionally and legally, Trump is on solid ground. Since D.C. has a unique status and the feds have taken over the police department, there has been useful collaboration between the federal and local law enforcement officials. The early returns have been encouraging, with the city seeing a moderate dip in crime. None of this would apply to Chicago or Baltimore. The federal government has no special role in governing them, and politically hostile mayors would maintain full control of their police departments. The emphasis should surely be on resistance to unwelcome federal intrusion rather than reluctant cooperation. Now, this was true in L.A. as well, but the riots and obstruction of federal immigration enforcement gave Trump the authority to federalize members of the California National Guard and protect federal assets. Unless similar unrest breaks out in Chicago or Baltimore, Trump is going to have a stretch for a legal justification for deploying the National Guard and risk a high-profile legal reverse. Regardless, the National Guard has limited utility as a police force. Its boots on the ground can create a sense of safer environment and perhaps, at the margins, free up local police resources for other duties. But what places like Chicago need is more intensive policing in high-crime areas. The National Guard is not going to, nor should it, become de facto cops making gang and drug arrests in the south and west sides of the city. The FBI and DEA, on the other hand, could actually help. At the end of the day, there is no easy cure for flagrant misgovernment of cities like Chicago. It is a long-term, deep-rooted ideological and political phenomena that won't be easily reversed, whether the troops in camouflage show up or not. Rich Lowry is editor of the National Review. There was one obituary this week. Mary N. Linthicum, 94, of Clinton, passed away at 12 a.m. on August 31st, 2025, at Goldwater Care in Clinton. Services were conducted at 11 a.m. on Thursday, September the 4th, at Calvert Funeral Home, with the Reverend David Dunlop officiating. Burial followed at Memorial Park. Memorials may be directed to Neighborhood Care Center of Clinton. This is Pat, and I'm signing off for today. Please have a good day, and I look forward to be back with you in the near future. Goodbye.